Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. Now, this is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep that open mind. In that way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. And folks, I think that's going to be important tonight. You may be curious as to why I have a gentleman who is a porn star and porn producer on, but I was intrigued because he applied to me, and he went into a doctoral program to study the mainstream consumption of, I guess it's pornography, it says, under the tutelage of an evolutionary psychologist. His name is Dave Pounder, and he has produced, directed, and performed in adult films for over a decade with over 100 titles to his credit. He holds a bachelor's degree in finance from Michigan State University and a master's degree in information management from Arizona State University. He has studied media economics and human sexuality at Indiana University. Excuse me. Oh, dear. Oh, sorry about that, folks. My husband thinks that I need to have a scanner in my room. So, and I do not. At any rate, he studied media economics and human sexuality at Indiana University and was accepted into the doctoral program at Concordia University in Montreal, again here to study the mainstream consumption of ography under the tutelage of evolutionary psychologist Dr. God Saad. Pounder has lectured on the topic of adult entertainment at several policy and academic institutions, including Indiana University, UCLA, and Emory University. And he currently lives in Boca Raton. I'd like to welcome Dave Pounder. Dave, how are you tonight?
Doing well. Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I am always interested in anybody. I have yet to reject anybody that has applied to be on my show. And I'm very interested, number one, in why you decided to apply to be on this particular program.
Well, I mean, like anything else, I think it's always interesting to have a conversation, you know, regardless of what the show is. I mean, even if the show is about gardening, right, you know, it would be interesting to talk about gardening, to have a conversation about gardening, to get different perspectives about gardening. And I think spirituality...
Right.
Spirituality is something that I think is central just to our existence. I think really to all really sort of complex mammal experiences, if you will. I mean, I would argue that, you know, chimpanzees and these and our sort of our other primate cousins also have spiritual experiences. People like Franz De Waal, who study chimpanzees and bonobos, you know, would agree with that. So yeah, I think from my perspective, I think there's this disconnect between really you know, spiritual expertise and sort of everybody has an opinion. And what I mean by that is
yes.
if you go to like a physics conference, right? If I walk into a physics conference and there's a professor of physics giving a lecture and I say, you know, that's not really how I see physics. You know, I would kind of be laughed out of the room because I'm not a physicist. My opinion really doesn't matter. Really, there's really no substance to what I'm saying as a non-physicist. So what happens is we have this, I think, false premise that religion is sort of the domain of expertise when it comes to spirituality. And
right.
I would reject that. I think a lot of people get spirituality
absolutely.
From religion. Yeah, but I think that you can absolutely be spiritual and moral and all these other things, either believing in sort of a greater sort of a multiverse concept or nature and sort of just the natural beauty of the world, or even just being completely atheistic and just thinking sort of like pure chaos theory that everything is random and we're just, you know, here by a random sequence of events. So it's interesting to hear, you know, I don't know what your sort of spiritual beliefs are. It would be interesting to hear those in our discussion. I can share mine with you and we can sort of have an intellectual conversation about what makes sense.
Well, let's do that. Let's do that and let's talk about your career, how you got there, your own journey, and let's talk about your work, your book, and we'll try to cover all of that in the course of the hour. As far as my own spiritual beliefs go, they're very eclectic. I was raised in a Christian tradition, and I believe religion's only valid when it serves the soul, and a lot of religion only serves people who want to live in guilt and fear and who like to be controlled and spoon-fed simple truths that may indeed be lies. And I believe that all religions are possibly valid if they serve the soul and if they bring a person to a sense of security and know that God is love. I reject any notion that God is anything but love. Call it God, goddess, universe, higher power, collective consciousness, you name it. So that's basically where I come from. I believe in reincarnation. I believe that we have a chance to perfect whatever lessons we may not have learned, the errors that we may have made. I do not believe in sin. I believe that sin is a shame and that no shame is good. Having had a background as a sex addict and a gay man who had a hard time coming to terms with that, I reject shame. I think it's toxic. And in Aramaic, the definition of sin is simply missing the mark. So those are a few of my thoughts. I've most recently belonged to a church called Unity Church, which is a very open, affirming church that embraces, it's basically called Practical Christianity, but they accept the validity of all great spiritual thinkers and religious beliefs. And I've since divorced myself from that because I've felt that I've gotten what I could out of that. And so now I have a group that meets called Free Spirits. And what we are a group of seekers who are seeking to evolve and learn from one another and not be under the mercy of a minister who is playing just one tape at different levels. We want to resonate at all levels and get as much collective wisdom as we can. So that's what's going on for me, and I'm just going to put my dog across the hall. So how about you, Dave?
Well, Bobby, so your philosophy almost sounds almost Buddhist in a sense. So have you explored Buddhism at all in any capacity?
Not really. My former partner was in it. Now he proclaims he's an atheist. And
well,
I think he's one of the most spiritual people I know. And my current husband, who really is a wife in a man's body, go figure, because I was always attracted to manly men, he has had a faith crisis and doesn't really know where he's at with that. So it's not that I'm out on a limb, but I've had people who have not embraced where I'm coming from, and that makes it a challenge in the course of a relationship to not be resonating at the same level.
Yeah, I've noticed that trend. A lot of people start off in a monotheistic religion, and then they move toward either a polytheistic or something like a Buddhist type of a situation, and then they ultimately, you know, people who are really doing a lot of research and thinking kind of end up, you know, agnostic and then atheist. It seems like you kind of followed that path.
Well, just to set the record straight, I do believe in monotheism, one God that resides within us and all of nature,
okay.
And that God is everywhere present, everywhere powerful and benevolent. So I'm not into polytheism, although I do believe that we receive help from many different levels. I believe in angels, spirit guides. I believe in the archangels. So those are a few other things I believe in.
Do you believe in a personal God that can actually hear and respond to your prayers and intervene in your life?
Not really. No.
Okay.
I believe that God is loving and wants whatever is best for, quote-unquote, his children. However, I believe we're co-creators. I'm very much aligned with the thinking of Esther Hicks and some of these people that channel entities, if you will, like Abraham, whereby we are all co-creators with God and that we are just as powerful as God.
And when you say God is good, are you implying that he or she has some kind of a consciousness or an ability to make good and bad decisions?
I believe that his consciousness comes from the collective consciousness of all.
Okay,
I guess
my question is like, think of something like this. Like, take the Asian tsunami, right? Like the Asian tsunami, you had all of these kids who were basically, you know, they were infants, 1 year old, 2 years old, who were basically killed in the tsunami, right? So, you know, the argument is if this God, and I don't know if this is the God you believe in or not, but if there's a God who's, you know, omniscient and omnipotent and has all this power, the fact that children by the thousands would be allowed to die in a tsunami means either that he's impotent and he can't act or he's not all powerful, or that
right.
he's evil and chooses not to intervene. So
no.
What I'm wondering is when you say, you know, all powerful, or, you know, and what you were saying earlier, does this God that you believe in have the power to prevent tsunamis from happening, to interject into the world and make things happen?
Well, yes.
Or not?
Yes, if that is the collective consciousness of the souls who might be affected by the tsunami. But then we get into the law of cause and effect and karma. The fact that we all have free will in any of our lifetimes, thereby we may indeed choose to have the experience of a tragedy, what one would call a tragedy, like a tsunami or cancer or tornado or you name it. So I don't believe God is indifferent. I believe he is there to guide us in our own personal development, and that at a soul level, we choose the lifetimes and the challenges that we wish to experience in order to round out our souls, which are the collection of many, 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 many lifetimes.
Right. That's what I'm trying to get my head around. So the fact that children died by the thousands in the tsunami, is this something that could have been prevented by God or could not have been prevented by God? Or maybe are you arguing that the mass of the adults had such bad energy or bad karma that the children were sort of, you know, the byproduct along with everybody else dying from the tsunami? Or how, in other words, if you believe that there's an omniscient God who's all powerful and all knowing and can
mm-hmm.
not allow a tsunami to occur, what is the rationale for allowing the tsunami to have occurred and to kill thousands, scores of children who are completely innocent? Like what would allow that to happen?
All innocent. We're children and adult children, but I'm following you. I'm following you.
Yeah.
I believe that prayer is powerful, and that if we're aware of something like a tsunami and we wish to avert it, that it can be averted. I believe, for instance, that Jesus could affect the weather and change the weather. I believe the mass consciousness of mankind affects everything that happens at a natural level. And it's not that God doesn't care about innocent children or adults, because adults are children at a heart level. But I do believe that each soul, and sometimes it involves collections of souls who come in family systems or larger systems, choose to have an experience like a tsunami for whatever reason, because there's always good that comes out of tragedy. People that step in to help out the survivors, people that learn lessons around grieving and that learn lessons around compassion, you name it. And we could do a whole show on this, Dave, but where are you coming from? And what are some of your beliefs?
Absolutely. Well, okay, so first of all, like, my personal view is, well, here's sort of my philosophy behind how I think these ideas developed, is I know that if a Muslim, you know, has sex with a Christian and they have a baby, that the physiological birth process is no different than if an atheist had sex with a Jewish person. It's not like the
right.
birth process is different based on your faith. So that
right.
logically follows that the death process is the same. It's not like, for example, Christianity and Islam are completely incompatible. If you're going
right.
to be successful under the Islam religion, you have to believe in the divinity of Muhammad. If you're going to be successful meaning into the afterlife and, you know, happy, you have to believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ. So these are, and you can't have any other gods. I mean, so these are these monotheistic, all or nothing type of religions that are mutually exclusive.
Oh.
It's one or the other. There's no room for compromise.
Right.
So the question is, so then you have to argue as well, can people die differently? If you're a Muslim and you die one way, you go to heaven. If you're a Christian, you die the other way. You both go to heaven because you believe differently. I would reject that using the
I would too.
Analogy. Okay, so now that we know that there's basically one way to die, we don't really know what that is yet, but that there's one way to
right.
die, we also
right.
know that there's 10,000 documented world religions. 10,000. And just because one religion has more subscribers doesn't necessarily make it any more true than somebody
That's
else.
Right.
I mean, there could be a religion that has 5 followers. That could be the correct followers.
Yeah, you're right. And that's
right?
probably,
so,
you're probably, they're probably closer to the truth, perhaps.
Yeah.
You never know.
Well, the thing is, so you have so assuming that one of them is right, if you even assume one is right, which I would even potentially reject that, your probability of making it is 1 out of 10,000. Or the more, I think, likely argument is your probability of being, you're destined to damnation is 9,999. Out of 10,000, you know, assuming that one of them is correct. Now, the other thing that I think is interesting is when you look at people's religious beliefs, the number one predictor of what they believe is their geography. If you were born in the Middle East, there is a very, very high likelihood you are Muslim. If you were born in the United States or Europe, there's a very non-Nordic Europe, there's a very, very high probability that you are going to be Christian or some denomination of Christianity. If you are born in India or the East, there is a very high probability that you are polytheist, Hindu, Buddhism, etc.
Right.
You know, if you're born in the Nordic countries, then there's a high probability that you're going to be secular. So the fact, you know, you can't predict human universals, death, birth, etc., what happens after life, based purely on geography, right? Like,
no.
And that's what it is. I mean, you know, it's very rare that if you took someone at random from the phone book in the United States, that they would be a Muslim. And it's very rare that if you took somebody at random from, you know, Afghanistan or Iran, that they would be a Christian.
Right.
And the fact that you're born there doesn't make it any more true. I think it's just this idea that you're sort of spoon-fed this theology. I mean, you know, I think Richard Dawkins says it good when he says, you know, or says it well when he says, you know, that child is not a Jewish child. That's a child of Jewish parents because the kid isn't old enough to really
You've got it.
Look
You've got it.
And make those that analysis. You know, how can he? And most people what I find is most people who are atheists are actually people who are like myself who are knowledgeable about various religions and what their tenets are, whereas people
mm-hmm.
who are devout religious never even looked at another religion. You look at people who
yeah.
are devout Christians. They've never read the Quran. They don't know anything about Islam. You know, you talk to people who are devout Muslims, they haven't read the Bible. They don't know anything about Christianity. I mean, once people start actually, you know, delving into the literature and looking at the inconsistencies and things like that, that's when I think they become atheistic in the sense of, you know, well, all of this is conflicting. You know what I mean? It just doesn't make
I
any
do.
Sense.
I do, and I'd like to make a few comments because I think you've raised some very interesting points. Now, as far as the geography of religion, it all makes sense to me. I mean, it's whatever our opportunity is and whatever our exposure in life is to what shapes us, and yet from the standpoint of reincarnation, and by the way, I do past life regression, and I've been able to regress every single person with amazing detail. We lead thousands of lives, and we've lived all over this planet and all over the cosmos. I did not used to believe in extraterrestrial life, although I thought it was an extreme possibility, but now I've changed my mind about that. and we always have the right to change our mind. And I'm not here to convince anybody that my way is the right way, but on the subject of deification, I believe that it is incorrect to deify Muhammad or Jesus Christ, that we are all divine beings equally worthy of God, that we are all children of God with the same potential as Jesus. That's what I maintain.
Right. Okay. So let's go with that and a couple other things. So you posit what you just posited, right? Now, and then, you know, a Muslim will posit his belief in Muhammad, a Christian will posit his belief in Christianity, and I'm going to basically posit my belief in nothing, right? And the thing is what I've noticed is a lot of these religions, they don't have any analytical basis to their beliefs. I'm curious, after I explain mine, what yours is for why you believe what you believe. And here's why I believe that nothing is the key. First of all, we are mammals. You know, humans don't fall into a difference. It's not plants, reptiles, you know, mammals and humans, right? Humans fall into the mammal species. We share 99% of our genetics with chimpanzees and bonobos. We're basically just another great ape. And humans, I believe there might be one or two others, but I believe only humans are the only ones who are aware of our own death, that we're going to die. My understanding,
right.
There might be a couple others.
There might be some consciousness around that in other mammals. Who knows?
Yeah, but from people who study primatology, like Franz De Waal, these other people, my understanding is that humans are the only ones that know we're going to die. And I think this is why we're religious, because we fear the unknown and we are afraid. Now, here's the thing. I don't disagree that George Washington or Abraham Lincoln were here. There's photos, there's evidence, there's a gazillion written journals, there's actual, you could probably, take his body out of the grave and exhume him or whatever they call, and you can prove that they were there. Now, I wasn't there. I know I wasn't there. There's no record of me. I wasn't waiting to be born, sitting there going, oh man, another 50 years, you know, I'm so bored, when am I going to be born, right? I think when you die, the same thing happens. And I talk about this in my book, actually, when I talk about religion, is, you know, I look at it like a computer, right? So when you turn on the computer, the memory populates. And, so the BIOS, the computer BIOS, is basically your education, you know, your learning, your DNA imprint. And when you're booting up, you're going to school, you know, you're learning. Now you're fully booted up, right? And all the files in the computer are sort of the cultural artifacts that are left behind. Music, this podcast, or radio show, you know, books, journals,
right,
et cetera.
Right.
And the memory reads those files, right? And then now it's in memory, and the memory can create other files, it can create other things, you can edit things, whatever, you can make other files on the hard drive. That would be me writing a book, you recording this podcast. Now, you and I die tomorrow, that's the same as the computer turning off. The memory is all gone. The memory is no longer present, it's not doing anything, it's dead. But the artifacts that you left behind, the music files, everything that you did while you were in memory, are still there. When you return on the computer, new memory populates. Think of that anecdotally,
right,
as like or by analogy, as a new generation. That generation then reads my book, listens to your podcast, you know, it gets into their memory, they do things, repopulate the hard drive, computer shuts off, they die. I think people are just afraid of dying and going into eternal nothingness, you know? And so I don't know. I think part of the reason I kind of reject the reincarnation idea is because, again, most, if not all, other than human species, are not aware of their own death. And I think humans are just basically insecure, and they fear the unknown, and they tell themselves that it's going to go on forever. They were so close to grandma and grandma died. And the only way that they can get solace from that is to say, oh, well, grandma's in a better place, and we're going to see her later. Otherwise, they'll be grieving indefinitely, or it'll be too difficult for them to handle. But at least I can argue, when I make my nothingness approach, that you just go into nothingness in the future. There's no incarnation. There's no afterlife. There's nothing. There's just no consciousness. You might as well be dead. I think that's consistent with where we were before we were born, right? So I can make that as a data point of at least some kind of educated guess of what happens after life, where these other religions don't. So I think that's one item to at least start the discussion with.
Well, I think the discussion has already started, and I don't seek to argue with you. I think I everything you say makes perfect sense to me. However, I don't agree with it. And one of the reasons I don't agree with it is because I've had out-of-body experiences where I have been in communion with a higher consciousness. And also, when I've regressed people, they have remarkable detail. And so I say that memory does not cease. Yes, it ceases in that particular body, but at a soul level, it's still accessible. And every single person I've regressed, and I challenge you to do a regression with me sometime, has been able to see past lives with incredible detail. But you have to have an open mind. If you close your mind, it will not work. So that's something that we could do for fun sometime if you're open to doing it. But, I guess I'm not sure where to go with this, but it's very interesting, and I do not argue with anybody. I believe that we're finding common ground as we talk. We may not be in agreement, and that's perfectly okay, because we all have the right to our own opinions. And I believe that at a certain level, there's some truth to the idea that you shouldn't use incendiary topics to talk because it can cause arguments like sex, politics, and religion. However, I talk about all those.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't give a shit. I do not give a shit. I talk about all of it because, you know, otherwise you've got blinders on and you get into judgment and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, like I said, for me to have somebody that's in the porn business on the show was a mind blower for some people. And I say, who are you to judge? You must be a prude. You are not open-minded. And so I say no to you. Not
right.
You, Dave.
But the nice thing about our conversation is I can say I look at it kind of like a scientific discussion, right? Like you got these two professors that are talking about physics, and one says, "Well, I think energy operates in this way," and somebody else says, "Well, that's not how I choose to believe to think about energy." And then they explain why they think certain ways, and then they challenge each other and go, "Well, have you thought about this or have you thought about that?" So my question for you, back to what you said last, is, you know, you're mentioning how, you know, that this sort of consciousness or, you know, goes beyond life, right? Like this energy.
Yes.
So my question for you is we know scientifically that consciousness resides in the brain. So we know, for example, if somebody hits me on the head with a brick, right, and then I'm unconscious and then all of a sudden maybe I wake up and they hit me really hard, I know that it's going to be, if I have severe, you know, head trauma, that my language skills are going to go, are going to worsen. I'm not going to be able to recognize the people maybe that I did. I might, you know, my mom or my brothers might walk into the room. I may not recognize them because of the head trauma.
Right.
I might not be able to speak English. But what's interesting to me about these religious arguments is we know that there's a, or spiritual arguments that you make is, we know that there's a direct correlation between the level of brain integrity and the ability to use language and process consciousness. So we know that as that is slowly – so if a brick – or not a brick, but if a car falls on my head and now my brain is completely smashed and I'm dead, what is the logic for arguing that you would have full verbal reasoning, ability to recognize people, and all these things that you would be able to do under what you described if – the entire center of the body that processes that information is just completely destroyed?
Well, I think at a human level it's gone. But I think that the spirit, I believe that the spirit still observes. Now, as far as what you were saying about science, it makes sense. But let's look at science today, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and how that's evolved. So what you put forward or posited about science today in connection with spirituality or religion may indeed be valid, but who knows where it's going to be 100 or 1,000 years from now. And when you look at things like quantum physics and how that is starting to blow people's minds in new directions, who knows where we're headed? And I'm not an expert on any of that. All I'm saying is that we are evolving whether we want to or not.
At all levels. Yeah, of course. We're going to know a lot more 100 years from now than we know today. We know more. Like, think of it like this. Back in the day, they had Indian tribes that would actually do rain dances and chants in the hopes of getting better weather for their crops. And they thought that if it didn't rain, that they didn't please the gods and they didn't dance correctly or, you know, whatever they had to do. And they thought that if it rained a lot, that their dances and chants were working. all of a sudden the science of meteorology comes out and says, low pressure, you know, lots of rain. High pressure, no rain. You can, you know, sit on your butt all day long, and if it's a high pressure system, it's going to be nice weather, and you can dance all you want if it's a low pressure. So once the science came about, people said, okay, there's really no reason to do these rain dances anymore. I mean, people who might have believed that and then no longer do. So you always see kind of religion and spirituality taking a back seat to advances in science, I've noticed. I mean, even if you look at the fact that we can now clone animals, I mean, you can clone people, you know. So I'm curious what you think about that. Like, if you cloned a person, I mean, they've cloned sheep and they've cloned dogs, and people have souls. Are you cloning the soul, or is there
no way? No way. A soul comes into the body at birth, and it's whatever soul wants to come in. It's not going to be the same person. It may have a similar personality, but it'll have a different soul. But you know, there's so much I want to cover with you. And
I'm an open book. Ask away.
Okay. Well, are you willing to go longer than an hour? Let's start there.
Yeah, we can, as long as we don't bore your listeners.
Well, who cares? You know, the ones that are bored will tune out anyway, and some probably already have. Some people don't like spiritual people, although the people that listen to my show generally tend to. Some people don't like atheist people, and it sounds like you're professing to be one, although I totally disagree with that. I believe you're a very spiritual person, and when we started talking out, that's where I thought you were coming from, and you talked about spirituality and animals, and I believe that, you know, our emotions may stem from thoughts, etc., but I just am a believer in spirit, and the only reason I am is because of experiences that I've had out of the body. Now, as a child, I was spoon-fed religion, and I wanted to believe, but I didn't truly believe. So, you know, it's something that I can't tell you, Dave, how to achieve for yourself. I would say time will tell the story, and that you will find out in the end, one way or the other, whether or not there is life after this. And perhaps it doesn't matter, but for those that are afraid, I'm saying, you know, open your mind and consider the possibilities, and there are certain exercises that you can do to get in touch with your spirit, you know, like meditation, for example.
Oh, I love meditation. Meditation is great.
And you know, whether or not you consider that you get in touch with your spirit, it's a calming technique, yes?
Absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't call it getting in touch with my spirit. I would call it kind of focusing on the present moment and enjoying.
Right.
You know, because the past is a memory arising in the present, and the future is really, you know, when you think about the future, you're anticipating the future, but you're still having those thoughts in the present. And I think a lot of people have monkey brain. Yeah, they monkey brain. They're jumping all over the place. Where if you actually just focus on your breath and you focus on the wind or the breeze or, you know, the noises that you hear, you start living more in the present moment. Now, to your earlier point, atheism is really void of content. I mean, saying you're an atheist is like saying you're a non-astrologer, saying that you don't, you know.
Okay, so that's the wrong term to apply to you.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just an atheist. I'm absolutely an atheist. And by atheist, it means that I reject all of these sort of religious claims. I just reject
them.
There's no
atheism. Okay.
Void of content. Sure.
Okay. Well, I've never had anybody explain it to me, so thank you for that. Let's talk first about your current work, and then let's discuss your journey, and we do have callers on the line too.
Sure. All right. Well, now I have an education business, a real estate business. I got out of the adult film industry, not because of any, you know, moral issues or anything like that. It was just that there are, you know, there's no more money in pornography. I mean, people get pornography for free. Back when I had internet sites, you know, we had 12,000 members on our sites. We were billing $30 a month. We were doing really well. And then all of a sudden, you know, YouPorn and Pornhub and all of these tube sites basically came on board, and people no longer pay for porn. Talk to anybody you know who watches porn, which is, you know, most men, and ask them, when's the last time you took out your credit card and paid for content? And it'll be hard-pressed for you to find one. But if you asked that same question 10 years ago, it would have been very easy for you to find one. So leaving the porn industry was not a spiritual thing. It was purely a business thing. And it's kind of like saying, why did you get out of the VHS tape business or the Betamax tape business? It's like, well, because once DVDs came out, nobody was buying VHS and Betamax anymore. And, you know, now that everything is video on demand and streaming video content, nobody's producing DVDs anymore. So, you know, nobody would think about starting a DVD replication business today when all of the media is shifting toward video on demand downloads, you know, and things like that. So, but I mean, when I was in it, it was great. You know, why did I get into it? I had an opportunity. I was at a swingers club, and I was hooking up with this guy's wife, and there was a porn scout there, and he saw me, and he thought that I'd be good for the movies. So I got his number, and I went down there, and I just had kind of like an extra role, like playing. I was playing a husband. He was actually at the swingers club trying to recruit real couples to go for this video series called like Screw My Wife Please. And so it was like real couples, and the real porn guy would come in, and the husband would watch the porn guy with his wife and get all turned on. So I was playing a fake husband, and they hired a porn girl to basically pretend she was my wife, and I was watching her have sex with this guy. And the girl was into me. She wanted to have sex with me too, but I couldn't because I didn't realize you had to get a test, you know, to work in the business. So, but that was the sort of the impetus of my career in the adult film industry. I just started networking. And then I got tested, and I went to an agent, and then I got more work, and then one thing led to another. And then I just ended up producing or performing and then directing and then producing. And now I still do some consulting work here and there with companies that are, you know, looking to get knowledge. I do a lot of consulting with Wall Street banks and people that are looking to make investment decisions in large-scale adult media products. Not so much just the content, but also hosting companies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still side money. And, of course, there's residuals, you know, from the old content when people are still, you know, streaming. If they do stream, if they go to, like, Hot Movies or AEBN and download our content or, you know, Clips for Sale or these other sites that have our content. And then, of course, we have the book. By the way, let me promote the book if people are interested in the evolutionary psychology.
Please do, and tell us where to get it.
Absolutely. Go to obscenethoughts.com. ObsceneThoughts.com, and the book is called Obscene Thoughts, A Pornographer's Perspective on Sex, Love, and Dating. It was an Amazon bestseller twice, and it won the Psychology Award at the American Library Association back in 2014, I believe it was. And it's a great book, and it's got a lot of academic support behind it, a lot of blurbs from economists, psychologists, public health professors, et cetera. Then I have a documentary called Risky Business, A Look Inside America's Adult Film Industry, which is a political and public health documentary. You can get that at riskybusinessthemovie.com. Again, riskybusinessthemovie.com. I think it's like $5 to watch it, and the trailer's free. And it just gives people a real analysis of the adult film industry. You know, you see these other producers that put out movies that completely make the porn industry look terrible, and then you have these other producers who make it look awesome. And this kind of shows both sides. It shows the upside, and it shows the downside. And you hear all sides, and you can walk away.
Okay. What is the upside, as you see it?
The upside.
I know the downside. I know the downside.
The upside, if you're a girl, is you get great money. I mean, you have no education. You know, you take a girl who has – she can't be a lawyer. She can't be a doctor. She can't be a banker. She's 18 years old. She can work at Starbucks and make $8 an hour, or she can make $1,000 a day and work just a few hours and then spend the rest of the week at the beach. And a lot of girls do that. So the free time, you know, the sort of time management or free time is a huge benefit for guys and girls. For women, especially the money. And then there's travel. You know, you travel all around the world. You go to trade shows. You shoot scenes in Europe, Brazil, South America, Mexico, the U.S., Canada. I mean, you go everywhere to shoot these movies, and the producers put you in nice hotels, and you know, you fly around. You know, and for the guys, I mean, instead of expending resources to try to have sex, you know, you go to a bar, you try to charm a girl or meet her, spend money on her, and maybe have sex. You basically have guaranteed sex with a very attractive girl, and you get paid to do it. And it's the sex in itself is a fringe benefit, not to mention the decent pay, not as good as the girls. The guys make about half what the girls make. And you have a great lifestyle, you know. But now that all the producers are kind of, you know, now that 90% of the producers are out of business, if not more, because nobody's producing content anymore because everybody's pirating it, there's less and less work available. So it's kind of good.
Well, what happens to people who don't have educations like you, and you've got extensive education experience, or have never, you know, established a career path for themselves once their looks begin to fade and they're no longer young enough to be in porn? What happens to those people? Have you done any follow-ups on any of them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you got to remember there's different genres in porn. I mean, it's not that not everybody wants to see the 18 to 23-year-old. I mean, you have what they call the MILF.
Right.
You
know, I know there's older porn,
yeah,
too.
And then there's the granny porn, you know. But there's not as much work. I mean, obviously, if you're 20 years old, you're going to get more work than if you're 35. And if you're 35, you get more work than when you're 45. But what happens is a lot of these girls, like, if they don't have education or they don't use porn as, like, a income source to do other things, they just kind of stay there and hang out. What happens is most of them end up just escorting. So they end up saying, okay, I'm just going to see private clients. And they kind of bank off of their name. They're like, hey, I'm so-and-so. I've seen all these movies and, you know, have sex with me. And they do that, and they escort. And there's a lot of demand for older escorts because, you know, they're more reliable. They show up on time. They're usually a better experience from people that I've talked to that have hired them compared to the 19 or the 20-year-old. And then the problem is then once they're, like, you know, 55, 60, and nobody wants to hire them anymore, then it's really difficult because they don't have any work experience. They probably haven't they usually don't save their money, unfortunately. And it can be it can be bad, you know, and it's difficult for them to get into relationships as well. All they've done is had sex with people their whole lives. So, and the documentary kind of talks about that as well, or, you know, employment discrimination. You know, you get out of the business and you get a job at, like, you know, a hospital, and they find out, oh, my God, the doctor used to do porn, and then the hospital tries to fire them, even though they're perfectly good surgeons or perfectly good teachers or perfectly good lawyers, you know, whatever it is that they're doing. There's this jump to just fire people because they made a movie. It's like, who cares? Like, you don't – oftentimes when they fire teachers, they'll say, oh, you know, let's fire this teacher because we found out that they did porn 10 years ago. And it's like, why? And they're like, oh, well, it's a bad role model for the kids. I'm like, well,
oh, that sucks. That sucks.
Yeah,
sorry.
But you don't just have sexual role models. I mean, you have nutrition role models. You have physical fitness role models. You don't fire fat teachers or teachers who eat fast food because they're setting a bad role model for the kids, especially.
No, I mean, we're just talking about societal judgment. And, you know, when you're on the fringe of whatever, you're going to be judged. That's just the part. That's
just
what happens.
And even for you as a gay man, I mean, 20 years ago, you know, if you were a teacher, you know, just the fact that you were gay, they would seek you out and they would fire you merely because you were gay.
Well, they still do in some places. Yeah.
True. But thankfully, you know, the gay rights movement has so much steam and so much support, you know, more mainstream support. We just legalized gay marriage, which is awesome. You know, I feel like people who are sex workers or people are kind of where the gay people were 15, 20 years ago. And I think
it's going to be decriminalized and drugs will be, at least marijuana. But, you know, I've known people in the business. I've known a lot of escorts and prostitutes and hustlers, and the way I've gotten to know a lot of these people is when they've come out of it. They've come into programs like Sex Addicts Anonymous, and when they have reviewed what they've done, and I'm not talking about people in porn here, I'm talking about people that, you know, sell their bodies for sex, that almost unequivocally, the people that I have known who've decided to take a spiritual approach to life say, you know, every time I did it, it was like giving a piece of myself away. And that is a big part of the reason I had to charge so much money, because it took an emotional psychic toll on me. And so I'm just wondering about that aspect, with regard to what you know about, you know, girls, as you say,
What you say is true of women. I mean, I have never met a girl in porn who has not had a prior history of sexual or sustained emotional abuse. They were molested, raped, you know, something happened.
Right.
But here's what I say in my book. You know, these are professional sex workers, right? Look at any professional golfer. I mean, of course, if you're a professional golfer, you were exposed to golf when you were a kid. If you're a professional ballerina, you were exposed to the ballerina world when you're a kid. So people who are going to go into professional sex work more than likely have been have experienced sexuality in some component at a younger age. So yeah, most women, when they're doing porn or they're doing just, even if they're not in porn, they're just hooking up with a different guy every night at the bar, it's really a cathartic experience for them. It's really catharsis. They're trying to recreate and master the experience to kind of learn what happened to them, and it never really works. The only way to really do that is to get therapy, and a lot of people can't afford to do.
Well, couldn't it also be at some level that they're reenacting their abuse by being possibly set up as victims, you know? Yeah.
That's what catharsis is, you're recreating.
Okay, I'm following you. Well, you know, it takes a lot of insight to be able to do that and or therapy. And, I just was very curious about it. And I was under the impression you were still involved in porn, and no judgment one way or the other. It sounds like you've made a very successful life for yourself, and I'd like to talk a little bit about your life journey. And we lost our callers. At least we have one remaining who does, for whatever reason, she never pushes one to speak to the host, and she goes into the queue. And when I call on her, she doesn't want to talk. Now, if she wants to talk and she's a friend of mine, please know I'm talking to you, dear, and call back, and I'll know that you want to speak with Dave. That will be my sign. And for anybody else that's listening, I would encourage you to press 1. I know there are people out there listening. I know people that have been excited about this show. Press 1 and talk to Dave and see where you can find common ground with him if you haven't already, because unless you dialogue with somebody, you're not going to get there, at least not all the way. And we do have another caller that just pressed 1. Let's go to that caller and then come back to talk. Journey, Dave, how's that? Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm mistaken. It's my friend. Somehow we just flip-flopped callers in the queue, meaning you and her, and I don't know why that is. But, Dave, let's talk a little bit about your life journey. Going quickly through childhood, the experiences that have shaped you, what's brought you to be the man you are today, and what were the major life questions for you along the way? What were the challenges for you? What have you overcome? How have you transformed? That kind of stuff.
Well, my friends laugh at me because they say that I've never experienced adversity. They're like, you've never suffered. You've never, because they always laugh because I'm always like happy and doing stuff. But no, I had sort of a picturesque childhood. I mean, my parents were together the whole time. They were never divorced. You know, I had private education, private schools, parents paid for college, had a good friend network. Everything was great. The only thing that sucked is I went to an all-guys Catholic high school, which kind of sucked because I didn't really get to interact with many girls.
And the Catholic the Catholic part too. Oh my.
Well, my mom's Catholic, so the thing is, she's from France. My mom's French, and she would always watch the news, and she would always see the Detroit, the Detroit news, and she thought that was like the whole region, and like if I went to the public schools, that I'd be having sex and doing drugs, and my mom thought that if I was at the Catholic school, that I would be like, sheltered.
Like
in other words,
right, choir boy.
And, what I thought was interesting was this is kind of where my aversion to religion kind of started. It was actually, I never really liked it. When I was a kid, I remember going to church. I'm like, why am I here? I'd rather be with my friends. I'd rather be playing basketball. This sucks. This is boring, it wasn't until I got to high school and, I would notice that we had these dress codes. We had to wear a collared shirt. We had to wear long pants. We couldn't wear tennis shoes. We had to wear not business shoes, but Rockport type shoes. And anyway, so what they did is they said, oh, well, by the way, we're having dress down day. If you pay $5, you can wear a Catholic Central T-shirt. You can't wear any other T-shirt, but you can wear a Catholic Central T-shirt. So I'm thinking, okay, it's not acceptable. Okay, let's just call it moral. It's not moral to wear T-shirts if you're a student at school, but you can wear a T-shirt if you give the school $5. And
yeah, agreed.
You know what I mean? I'm like,
greed, and also promotion. Go ahead.
Oh, it gets even better. It gets even better. So then they had, and it's a good school. Like academically, it was very good. But the thing is
uh-huh.
then they had this thing where we had to sell these raffle tickets to raise money for the school. So it was always in the second semester. Sell raffle ticket. Now, here's the thing. We had to sell about $100 worth of raffle tickets. If we sold $100, right, then you get Fridays off. You get your Fridays off for the rest of the year. So school was
uh-huh.
Monday through Thursday. But if you didn't sell the raffle tickets, you still had to show up to school and sit in the room with everybody else who didn't and just kind of hang out or read or do work or whatever. So your incentive was to go out and make money for the school, so that you could basically have your time off, which I thought was also BS. And then when I was in junior high, another religious school, we have to take time away from our class and lick envelopes to mail stuff out to the whoever the parishioners were at the church. I remember when I was in high school, we were obligated to take a religious course like sacraments or, the Old Testament, or where I would have rather taken law. Like, for example, my mom is French, so she wanted me to take French. And there's actual social benefit to taking a foreign language. So I took French one, and then I had to take sacraments and then the usual like math and English and stuff, right? And then when I was a senior, I wanted to take business law and accounting, and I had to pick one or the other. And I'm like, why do I have to pick one or the other? Why can't I take business law, take accounting, and then I'll not take Old Testament? You know what I mean? Like, Old Testament's a waste of time. Like, I don't want
to. Right, why not?
And you can't do that. It's required at the religious school for you to take Old Testament. So now I think I miss out on an opportunity. I ended up taking business law, but I missed out on the opportunity to take accounting in high school. So, and I'm thinking, well, if I went to the public school, I could wear T-shirts that say whatever I want them to say. I could wear shorts. It's a shorter drive. I can take, purely academic classes and not be sort of brainwashed by this religion. And, like I said, as I got older, I started noticing more and more things like take gay marriage. Like, the only people that are opposed to gay marriage are religious people. I mean, there's no academic reason to be opposed to gay marriage. From an equal rights perspective, why would you not let gay people get – I mean, if two people come together – I like the joke where they say let gay people get married. They have the right to be as miserable as everybody else, you know.
And a lot of them are, too. Yeah.
I know, right?
Who's going to define what is normal? That's what I'd like to know. I don't even – I will identify as gay, but I don't call myself a gay person anymore. I'm a human being who is coming in touch with who I truly am, and that's an aspect of my experience, but it's just another label.
Absolutely. It's kind of like saying, I may have blonde hair, but I don't identify as the guy with blonde hair. I just happen to have blonde hair. Sexuality should be the same way. We are moving in that direction slowly but surely. And eventually,
it's fluid.
Same with race.
Yeah, right, right. Well, so tell me more about your coming of age and whatever it is you want to share that has led you to get in touch with the Dave you are today, because chances are you may have known who you were at an early age, and then you may have attached yourself to all these labels. I don't know. You may have bought into some shit along the line that you've since gotten rid of. We all hopefully continue to grow and evolve, and we do whether we want to or not at some level, but some people evolve at a snail's pace.
Yeah, I mean, I've always, like anything else, I've always been an independent thinker. I've always did what I was going to do, regardless of what people said, as long as it was within the law, because I didn't want to go to jail. I wouldn't do well in jail. And, my beliefs change as I meet more people. I mean, I used to be pro-life when I was in high school, and then when I went to college, I had this roommate, Brad, who was one of the smartest guys I've ever met. I mean, he graduated 4.0 at Michigan State, went to University of Chicago Law School. Now he's working as an attorney for the NSA, one of the brightest, most amazing people I know. We had a – kind of like you and I are having this conversation about spirituality and religion. He and I had this conversation about pro-choice versus pro-life, and he cornered me intellectually. I'm like, crap, I can't go anywhere. I'm like, you win.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, all right, I guess you're right, Brad. Now I'm pro-choice for the reasons, that you describe. And it's the same thing like anything else. So I'm really libertarian when it comes to my political philosophy. Let people do whatever they want, but they shouldn't be allowed to harm others. So you can't shoot other people or rape other people, but you can do drugs if you want. You can hire a prostitute if you want. These
right,
crimes shouldn't be illegal. And, you know, I think somebody was asking me the other day, like, oh, you know, well, you say that, you know, you support raising the age limit from 18 to 21 in porn. And the reason I say that is because just, you know, people can make better decisions. But at the same token, it's like, you know what, like, they're right. Like, the age should stay 18. You know what I mean? If it's there at all. Because the thing is it's like you're taking away individual rights. You know, if someone's 18 and they want to make a porn video or drink alcohol, because you got to be 21 to drink alcohol here, who are we to say that we can't? I mean, they're adults. They can go fight a war. They can get killed. They can do whatever they want. I'm not a fan of the government taking away individual rights.
No, nor am I. I think we're all adults, and let's treat people with dignity. You know, that's my philosophy. If people choose to harm themselves, as long as they're not harming somebody else, so be it.
Right. And the thing I thought was interesting in recent news is this Kentucky clerk that's trying to deny the gay marriage licenses, citing religion, even though she's been divorced. She's been divorced, and there's all these other things that's part of her life. I saw this on this news channel the other day, where there's all these other things that this I think her name's Kim, that this Kim clerk does that's completely against her religion, like getting divorced and these other things. Yet she does. You know what I mean?
But it's like, a little hypocrisy, perhaps. Who knows? Yeah.
But yeah, no. I mean, listen, my life's great. I mean, I've had no. I mean, you know, if I had to fish for something that might be an impetus for why I'm in porn and stuff like that, the only thing I can think of is like I had this annoying brother that would like always eavesdrop on my phone calls. Like when my friend Sean and I were going to go to the strip club, he'd tell my mom, "Hey, mom, I'm going to the strip club," you know. And then what he would do is he would chase me around the house and like he always wanted to hang out with me, right? And like he was kind of annoying, so I didn't really want to hang out with him. But sometimes I'd hang out with him just to hang out with him, but like. He'd always call me like, oh, you know, cute and cuddly. And he'd chase me around the house. And then when I'm trying to like open my door, I had like a lock on my door. Cause when I wasn't there, he'd go in there and look at all my stuff. And he kind of like feel my arm or feel my leg, like almost like the way that you would caress a baby. But he never touched like private parts or he never like, there was nothing like overtly sexual. It was just more like, and I remember as a kid thinking this is weird. Like, why is he doing this? Get away from me, you know, kick him in the balls, you know, leave me alone, you know, like, so that would be the extent of the only thing that I could ever think about in my past, that, or the fact that my friend Sean and I used to steal porn when we were in junior high. Like I would distract the clerk. I'd be like, "Hey, how much are these M&Ms?" And like I'd throw all these candy bars in front of them, and then Sean would climb the rack because we were like in middle school. We weren't tall enough to get to the Penthouse magazine, to the Playboy on the top shelf, and then he'd put it under his shirt, and we'd go home and we'd sneak in our bathroom, and then we'd look at the pictures, you know what I mean? Or you know, trying to pay our older brothers to get us a porn video, and then we'd watch it. So I watched porn often when I was in high school, but most males do today anyways. I mean, with the internet now, you know, when we were kids, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, it was a challenge to get pornography. You had to know an adult, or you had to, like, you know.
Right. Same here. I think I'm probably older than you, but.
Okay. Yeah, but now these kids, they're so lucky. Like the boys, they can just take out their phone and type in vagina in YouTube or porn, and they get instant access. So the porn that I saw, even though it was more than my peers, I think at that time, is pales in comparison to what the average male sees today. And I really don't think there's anything wrong with it. I don't think, like, I'm a very well-adjusted sexual person. Like, I don't have any, I don't have any sexual issues or problems. My relationships are healthy. I mean, the only relationship issues I have is the fact that I don't really believe in monogamy, you know, like monogamy doesn't appeal to me, but I'm honest about it with girls that I meet. I say, listen, I'm not interested in monogamy. If it doesn't work for you, I understand. If you don't want to date me, that's fine. You know, and it scares 95% of girls away, but the 5% that it doesn't scare away, I have good relationships with them, you know? So, you know,
well,
I
have nothing against that. I have nothing against anything as long as it doesn't hurt somebody else. And, you know, I was married to a woman, for example, and I had come out to her before I got married. However, it turned out to be a hurtful experience for both of us because we were rather naive. And profess that one thing is okay, and then their discovery is along the way that it's not okay, and then so, you know, you just shift gears, that's all. But there was a question that formed in my mind, and it's left me. If it comes back, I'll put it forward to you. I think we will try to wrap up soon. What would you say is your life purpose for today? What is your life philosophy for today?
Honestly, there's two. There's a purpose and a philosophy. So my purpose, I believe, at this stage is to really use my intellect and resources and resourcefulness, basically, to help normalize sexuality, to break people free of this archaic religious sexuality. I mean, I feel like we've advanced in so many different fields, medicine, you know, law. You know, we no longer, you know, sacrifice our firstborn child like we did 5,000 years ago, you know, because we thought that our house would stand longer. You know, we've made so much progress, but we've made very little progress with sex education. I mean, we still live in a country where many states don't, their sex education does not have to be scientifically valid. You know, we're teaching people abstinence only in many places, many areas of the country, which we know doesn't work. We know comprehensive sex education does. So my goal is really to be an advocate for, you know, progressive social change regarding sexuality. The casual sex is fine. Bonobos do it. Chimpanzees do it. They're our closest genetic relatives. Most social higher mammals do. Dolphins have sex for pleasure. I mean, look at humans. I mean, we have sex when reproduction is not even possible. We have sex when women are pregnant. We have sex when women are menopausal. We have sex when women are on their periods. I mean, we have gay sex, right? We have sex where reproduction is not possible. I've argued and I continue to argue that sex is social and reproduction is really a byproduct of human sexuality. And that kind of falls into the bonobo chimpanzee model as well. That's really my purpose, is trying to challenge. You know, I do a lot of volunteer work with groups like Americans United for Separations of Church and State, American Civil Liberties Union, where we're challenging, you know, anti-discrimination, you know, like standing up for gay rights and things like this. So I want to help normalize sexuality and make it sort of the social thing that it is and do that. And then my lifestyle is really, you know, wake up every day at 11 because I'm not a morning person, wear my shorts and sandals everywhere that I go. You know what I mean?
I don't blame you. I would. I do. But I'm retired.
Treat others. Yeah. Well, treat others as you would, you know, treat yourself and be respectful to everybody. And, you know, like, you know, I everything's great. You know, live in a warm climate. Like live the life you want to lead. And for me, everything is going wonderful. I mean, I have no regrets and everything's great.
Oh, that sounds like a very spiritual life to me, Dave. Sounds very spiritual, I remembered what I was going to ask, and it comes back to pornography and when you were talking about the boys typing in vagina and getting whatever in their face. The only objection that I have to porn is that I think it tends to make people objectify body parts and people as sex toys, and I think that's can be a dehumanizing experience, can be. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with it. I don't believe there's any right or wrong other than what people do to others that hurt them. And there's a lot of gray area, and people tend to see things as black and white, and that's just plain stupid, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, in response to that, I think Don Simons said it best. He's an anthropologist at UC Santa Barbara. And what pornography, I mean, men basically objectify body parts. It's a male thing, not a female thing.
I know women that.
Say it again? I'm sorry?
I know women that do, too. Oh, yeah. People on sex addicts.
I can almost guarantee you that those women have a past history of sexual abuse or sustained emotional abuse. So I'm talking about.
They do.
Men.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, right,
you're
right. Exactly, right. But I'm saying the women who don't objectify body parts. And if you read my book, it shows the two different categories and how they operate. But men, irrespective, objectify body parts as their sexuality. And a lot of girls will say, you know, I don't like pornography because it objectifies women. And I said, well, if pornography revealed anything about how men feel about women, you know, lack of respect, contempt, etc., then you would expect gay pornography to be very different. But it's not. Gay pornography
same
as gay pornography.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. You have a younger target partners, a variety of partners, low investment sex. It's all the same stuff. So if pornography revealed anything about how men felt about women, gay porn would be very different. And since it's not, what pornography really does is it reveals male sexuality, our desire for low investment sex, our desire for partner variety, and all of these have evolutionary explanations. And if, for people who are listening to this and are interested in the psychology component of human sexuality, if you go to obscenethoughts.com and you just listen to some of the other interviews that I have at the site where we talk specifically about why men act that way and why females don't and why females act like men when they're raped and things like this. All of these things are discussed on the other videos that are at the obscenethoughts.com website.
Very interesting. Well, just a point for other people to ponder around sexual abuse is that I've heard statistics by a leading expert who's written a best-selling book, and I'm sorry I don't remember the name of the book or the person, that fully 25% of men have been sexually abused in their past, and that blew my mind because I'd previously heard it was 6%. And of course,
for women,
sex,
it's a third.
Pardon?
For women, it's a
women
third.
Women, it's a third. Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's probably underreported because victims tend to blame themselves and are ashamed. So, I mean, it could be even higher than that. But
they say it's a third, accounting for that. When they do like academic projections based upon lack of report and things like that, it comes out to a third. And I believe you. I think the 25% sounds about right for guys. I would say that that's probably correct around that.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, it certainly is just a human phenomenon and part of what shapes us as individuals and part of our life challenges, whether it has to do with human sexuality or just becoming a well-adjusted person, whatever that means.
True, but a key point, too, that I think is worth mentioning, though, a key point worth mentioning is both on the sexual abuse of men and women that I would argue that 95-plus percent of the perpetrators are men against both men or women. So
yes, I totally agree. And, you know, they're generally pedophiles, if you will, who have been sexually abused themselves. And fortunately, most sex abuse survivors do not become pedophiles. But, you know, there's a whole, you know, pathology behind that that we could have another show on. And I'm not an expert on it. And I don't and you probably know a lot more than I do. But what I'd like to do is two things. I'd like to invite you to email me again a year from now. And we'll do another show, okay?
Sure.
And
absolutely.
I've got some ideas for it. And likewise, I'm challenging you to do a past life regression with me. So give me a holler.
You got it. I appreciate you. Thanks again for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And hopefully your listeners enjoyed the conversation.
I think it was very scintillating. And I'm surprised that we had – my husband just walked into the room and is laughing. I'm surprised nothing against the person that hung up, but it just surprised me. You know, I'm learning things about people all the time, and maybe she just had to go. But as soon as we started talking about pornography, she went away. And my dear friend, who shall remain nameless, who's a loyal fan and is still listening, I'm going to call you later, honey, if that's all right. So, Dave, thanks again.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, so once again we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are all unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we open ourselves to it. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. And unlike what the outgoing message says, the place to find this podcast is here on blogtalkradio.com and on freespiritbroadcasting.com. And I now broadcast Sunday, Monday, Thursday, and Friday nights at 7:30 Eastern Time.